Hi, I'm VOA's Alexis Strope with your worldwide news update. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Thursday announced another $135 million in aid for Palestinians. AP correspondent Karen Shamus reports.
Speaking while on a visit to Doha in Qatar, Blinken has pressed Israel to allow more aid into the war-ravaged Palestinian territory.
We all know that it's not enough to provide funding. It's not even enough to get the assistance to the borders of Gaza. What's so critical is that the aid gets to the people who need it.
After Israeli forces killed top Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in Gaza last week, but neither side has shown any sign of moderating its demands. I'm Karen Chamas.
A Lebanon donors conference in Paris on Thursday has raised hundreds of millions of dollars for the war-battered country. VOA's Lisa Bryant has more from the French capital.
Dans l'immédiat, c'est une aide massive qu'il faut apporter à la population libanaise.
Conference host, French President Emmanuel Macron, said families need shelter, children need nourishment and schooling, the wounded need care. Solutions must be found quickly, he said, especially to avoid further population displacements, which could create new divisions in the country. Acting Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati wanted more.
What we as Lebanese expect from the international community is the following: solidarity and ceasefire. Lebanon calls on the international community to come together and support efforts that will end the ongoing aggressions and enforce an immediate ceasefire.
The Paris meeting additionally aimed to find ways to support the Lebanese army and the UN peacekeeping mission in the country, which includes a large number of European troops. Both the army and the peacekeeping mission say they have come under attack by Israel. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA News. South Korea's Presidential Security Service said that trash dropped around the presidential compound on Thursday came from North Korean balloons. It comes as propaganda leaflets were found scattered on the streets of South Korean capital Seoul. Reuters correspondent Diane Tao reports.
It appears to be the first instance of the North Korean government directly sending anti-South propaganda material across the border. Some of them made personal attacks on the South's President Yoon Suk-yeol and the First Lady. They accuse the Yoon government of failing its people and describe the first couple as immoral and mentally unstable. Since late May, North Korea has been sending thousands of balloons, often carrying trash, into various parts of its southern neighbor. It said the move was to retaliate for propaganda leaflets sent the other way by activists in the south criticizing the North's leadership.
Free North Korea!
Pyongyang has accused Seoul of being complicit.
Reuters correspondent Diane Tao. The owner and manager of the cargo ship that caused the Baltimore-Maryland bridge collapse have agreed to pay more than $100 million to settle a lawsuit brought by the U.S. Justice Department. The settlement comes a month after the Justice Department sued Dolly owner Grace Ocean Private Ltd. and manager Synergy Marine Group, seeking to recover more than $100 million that the government spent to clear the underwater debris and reopen the city's port. U.S. President Joe Biden is set to apologize on Friday for a 150-year Indian boarding school policy. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
President Biden says this should have been done a long time ago.
Make a formal apology to the Indian nation for the way we treated their children for so many years.
A government investigation documented nearly 1,000 deaths and 74 grave sites associated with more than 500 schools. In his apology, the president says, as a people who love our country, we must remember and teach our full history, even when it is painful. I'm Ed Donahue.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said on Friday that the transatlantic slave trade was abhorrent and that while history cannot be changed, it should be talked about.
I think we should be clear from the outset that the slave trade, slave practice was abhorrent. And it's very important that we start from that place.
Starmer was speaking in an interview on the sidelines of the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting held on Samoa and attended by leaders and officials from 56 countries with roots in Britain's empire. The idea of reparations for transatlantic slavery is longstanding, but has recently been gaining momentum worldwide, particularly in the countries of the Caribbean community and more recently the African Union. Opponents of reparation payments say countries should not be held responsible for historical wrongs, while those in favor say the legacy of slavery has led to vast and persistent racial inequality today. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barkley in Washington. Today is Friday, October 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The 2024 Ibrahim Index of African Governors says governance progress in Africa is grinding to a halt as security and democracy deteriorate.
I do think it's generally a leadership failure that governments on the continent have not committed themselves and delivered to the expectations of ordinary citizens on the continent.
Malawi police arrested a senior official of an opposition party on suspicion of conspiring to commit a felony. A UN official calls on South Sudanese citizens and political leaders to ensure lasting peace in their country. The Frelimo party candidate wins Mozambique's presidential election as expected.
The terrain is already prepared. Regardless of what we see, the enthusiasm, the dynamism of the young people that are rallying behind this opposition candidate.
And analysts say a handful of races across the U.S. will decide which party controls the Senate. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. This week, the Mo Ibrahim Foundation released its 2024 Ibrahim Index of African Governance, which assesses governance performance in Africa. The report, which covers the decade of 2014 to 2023, says governance progress in Africa was halted with the deterioration of security and democracy on the continent. Joseph Asonka is an expert panel member of the Mo Ibrahim Index of African Governance and the CEO of Afro Barometer. He tells me that the 2024 report is a sobering reminder of the threat that security crises and a shrinking environment for democracy pose for Africa's progress.
I think the biggest overall takeaway has been that the picture on the continent is quite dire, in the sense that both on the economic front and the governance front has encountered several challenges. And as the report rightly points out, Africa's governance in particular has almost grounded to a halt since 2022. If you may recall, between 2010 and 2012 or 13, it was the period of the Africa rising narrative. So Africa was pretty doing well at the time. The continent was relatively very stable. Conflicts were not as much as we have today, and certainly the economies of several countries were growing. There was relative peace. At the time, of course, there were some commitments by the African Union and, you know, state parties to ensure that Africa is well governed, that overall Africa will have increasingly become a global player. Unfortunately, that has not been the case, and the Ibrahim Index of African Governance does clearly reflect that over time, since 2014, through to date, governance and economic performance has been declining. And since 2022, governance has almost come to a standstill.
So what do you think? What do you think are some of the main factors contributing to this somewhat slow progress in governance?
I think the critical factor has been failure of government and leadership failure, I would say. And governance, of course, is the core component of development. If political stability is threatened, if governments do not govern according to the will of the people, this is what happens. So I do think it's generally a leadership failure that governments on the continent have not committed themselves and delivered to the expectations of ordinary citizens on the continent. The priorities that citizens have, especially when it comes to peace and insecurity, the report does highlight these two. And I think the inability to maintain peace and security, which was one of the commitments that was made under Agenda 2063 to silence all guns by 2023, that has not worked out. And so unfortunately, the continent's peace and insecurity has resulted in, you know, derailing the continent from achieving some of these targets.
What are some of the improved countries in governance?
The report does clearly note the countries that have really improved quite significantly. And this is actually a mix of countries that were already doing well and countries that had a lot of room for improvement. So, for example, the Seychelles comes up on top in terms of its governance ranking. And Seychelles has been a country where governance has been improving over time, and they have remarkably overtaken some of the stalwarts of democracy on the African continent, like Mauritius or Botswana, which have always been viewed as the torchbearers when it comes to democratic development. I think for some of the countries, example Morocco, that has moved to the 8th position, or countries like Cote d'Ivoire that has moved to the 16th position, these are countries that had a lot of room for improvement, and they've actually done well in that kind of movement. And so if you look at the top countries, especially the top performing ones, it is the countries like the Seychelles that have really done well to come to the top position. In some countries, the index has shown, in addition to Afrobarometer data, has shown that there are some concerns in some of the Africa's leading democracies. People's or citizens' satisfaction with the way democracy has worked. In countries like Mauritius, Botswana, South Africa, and Ghana, that used to be and are known as democratic stalwarts on the continent, the indicators for these countries have actually gone down. And that is the unfortunate thing, that some of the leading democracies have struggled. And as I said at the beginning, this comes down to leadership failure, of course, the inability to maintain peace and security.
Joseph Asanka is an expert panel member of the Mo Ibrahim Index of African Governance. He's also the CEO of Afrobarometer. He was speaking with me from California. As expected, official results from Mozambique's October 9 presidential election show ruling party candidate Daniel Chapo has won the presidency. The opposition says the poll was rigged and is calling for protest. Two opposition party figures were gunned down during protests that took place last week. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Maria Mandialo covered the election and has this report.
Frelimo Party candidate Daniel Chapo won the presidential elections with 70.67% of the vote, according to results released Thursday by Mozambique's National Electoral Commission. Independent candidate Venancio Mondlane finished second with 20%. The candidate for RENAMO, Mozambique's traditional main opposition party, won less than 6% of the vote. The result cements the power that the ruling Frelimo party has held since Mozambique won independence nearly 50 years ago. Some analysts predicted Frelimo would hold on to power despite the enthusiasm young voters expressed for Mondlane ahead of the vote.
The terrain is already prepared. Regardless of what we see, the enthusiasm, the dynamism of the young people that are rallying behind this opposition candidate, but we know that the status quo will prevail.
Mondlane has said the vote was rigged. As his camp was building a case to challenge the election results, two prominent members of his party were shot and killed last weekend. While some say the shootings were politically motivated, current president Filipe Nyusi, who condemned the killings, warned against jumping to conclusions. Earlier this week, police fired tear gas and bullets at opposition protesters in Maputo, while observer missions from the European Union and Southern African Development Community have yet to give final assessments of the October 9th election. The EU mission said this week that some of its 179 observers were prevented from observing tabulation processes in some districts, provinces, and at the national level. But some analysts say the political rise of relatively young candidates like 47-year-old Chapo and 50-year-old Mondlane is still a good development for Mozambique.
The youth have arrived in Mozambique, and I think that that's a good thing for Africa. And this is the first time that we see a turnover from the liberationist group in Mozambique. And so this is good. I hope that they bring youthful energy and they focus on the issues that are important to young Mozambicans.
Kweku Nwama says those included poverty and insecurity issues in the northeast, where the government is battling insurgents in the gas and oil-rich Cabo Delgado province.
What's going to happen in Cabo Delgado? We've seen the SADC troops leave. Now you have Rwandan and Tanzanian troops over there. Are they going to stay? In terms of poverty, what's the plan ahead? The World Bank shows that Mozambique's real poverty numbers around like 62%. People need jobs. People need to have some promise, some help from the state.
Meanwhile, runner-up candidate Mondlane has called for 2 days of national standstill and peaceful protest. A spokesperson for the U.S. State Department called on Mozambicans to reject violence and to use peaceful means to pursue electoral grievances. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 25th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. A spokesperson for the opposition United Transformation Movement, UTM Party, is calling on the Malawi police to release or charge a party official arrested on Thursday. A police statement says Patricia Kaliati was arrested on suspicion of conspiring with two others to commit a felony. Kaliati is the Secretary General of the UTM, the party of the late Vice President Saulo Chilima, who died in June in a plane crash. UTM spokesperson Phyllis Jawala tells me that the party suspects Kaliati's arrest to be politically motivated.
We received information in the morning around 10. That is at one of the at police headquarters. And when we went there to find out what are the charges, we are told she will be charged with felony. But they have not taken a statement from her. And by the time we left, they were still waiting for the officers to come and charge her.
So she was arrested but has not been charged?
No, she has not been charged yet.
What do you suppose is happening?
If our assumption is correct, we suspect this to be just a political arrest. We are yet to get details because since morning, the charges have not been raised to her. So we will again go there tomorrow to find out really what are the issues surrounding arrest.
When you say you suspect this might be politically motivated, what evidence do you have to say that?
The suspect comes when she has been at the police since morning but has not been charged with anything yet.
That's the only reason why you think it might be politically motivated?
Well, she's a politician. She has been very vocal lately, and the circumstances that probably happened to her arrest, you know, we suspect that it could be politically motivated because she has not been charged. If she was charged today, then he probably would have known exactly what the issues are. So, you know, putting her in custody, and I think that they are busy investigating. That, to us, is something that we are not sure what there is. That's why I'm saying until we get information, then we can say, okay, probably there are some issues that she must be dealing with.
The UTM is supposed to have its convention next month, November 17. Is there any connection? We understand there's a dispute within your party about this. What is happening?
Well, you know, you cannot conclusively say it's about the convention. It's about what's happening in our party. You know, in politics, so many things happen. And we just have to be very alert and vigilant in whatever is happening in the country, mainly when we are going to elections.
You say she has been critical of the government. What is the criticism about the government? What has she been saying?
The last press briefing she had was about the way Malawi Electoral Commission is conducting itself, the deficiencies that are there in the electoral process, something probably that may not have gone well with the government.
Phyllis Jawala is the spokesperson for the Opposition United Transformation Movement, the UTM Party of Malawi. You are speaking with me from the capital, Blantyre. The special representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan is calling on the country's citizens and political leaders to ensure lasting peace across the country. The UN mission in South Sudan marked United Nations Day in Eastern Equatorial State on Thursday with a call for national authorities to provide services to millions of people affected by conflict and extreme food insecurity. Kaltuma Vanessa reports for VOA from Turret.
United Nations Day reflects the official creation of the United Nations on October 24, 1945. Anthony Wapa, acting head of UNMISS Turret Field Office, who delivered the message of the UN Special Representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, says the United Nations Day renews commitments to protect the needs and interests of the present and future generation. He also says UNMISS has been working to address issues of development, conflict, and food insecurity.
Millions of people continue to suffer from conflict, compounded by climate shocks and extreme food insecurity. To help tackle those challenges, United Nations Family is working in partnership with the government and the people of South Sudan to ensure peace, security, and sustainable development. As UNMISS, we are doing all we can to prevent violence, build trust, and boost community confidence.
Peter Gumbo, the Minister of Legal and Parliamentary Affairs in Eastern Equatorial State, praised the UN for its contribution in supporting communities in the state on several levels.
In Eastern Equatorial State, the support of the UN has been crucial in addressing our most pressing challenges, from peace building to health, education, and economic development. Of course, I know they went through many challenges, including security concerns, lack of infrastructures, continuous local conflicts, mistrust and resistance from some of the local communities. But I would like to concentrate mostly here. The UNMISS, for example, through quick impact projects, opened police posts in the state, constructed and built three maternity wards in Kapoita North, Kapoita South, and Turit counties. They also constructed and built two primary health center units at Kauto in Kapoita East and Magui County. As we reflect on this year's theme, I extend our gratitude to UN for its continued partnership and dedication to our people.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan began as a peacekeeping mission in the country. UNMISS was established on July 8, 2011 by United Nations Security Council Resolution 1996 to keep the peace in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting from Eastern Equatorial State Capital Turit.
Whichever political party ends up controlling the House of Representatives or the Senate will be key to a new president enacting his or her legislative agenda. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson looked at the key races around the country.
Talk to voters and make sure they're voting all the way down the ballots.
Donna West, a longtime Democratic activist, does not just organize voters for Vice President Kamala Harris from her Las Vegas, Nevada garage. She says she is also fighting to make sure Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen keeps her U.S. Senate seat.
The more we can get out and talk to the voter, the more confident I am that we'll restore Jackie to the Senate and take that majority.
Nevada is one of just a handful of U.S. states nationwide with competitive Senate races that will determine if Democrats or Republicans hold the majority. Democrats currently hold a slim majority with 51 seats. Rosen's challenger, Sam Brown, who was injured while serving in Afghanistan, says it is time for change in Washington.
We've got an economy to go square away. And look, there's things we can do from the housing to our energy policy. We've got to go after this border situation.
In Texas, traditionally a stronghold for Republicans, polls show a close race between Democrat Colin Allred and Republican Senator Ted Cruz. In their debate last week, Allred challenged Cruz on the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol.
This election is his accountability.
You cannot just be patriotic when your side wins.
Cruz pushed back on that argument.
You don't hear him talking about the Antifa and Black Lives Matter riots that burn cities across this country.
And in the rural state of Montana, Democratic Senator John Tester faces a challenge from Republican Tim Sheehy. At the Democratic National Convention earlier this year, a delegate said that many voters in the state may vote for former president and Republican candidate Donald Trump, but will keep a Democrat in the Senate. Mary Jo O'Rourke is a Montana voter.
Senator Tester has delivered for us in terms of the farm bill, and we are way too smart to let that go.
But at the Republican National Convention, delegates said Tester's liberal voting record is not right for the state. Susan Renaud is a Montana voter.
Tim Sheehy is a real veteran. He is a combat hero. He is a Navy SEAL.
Control of the U.S. House of Representatives could also potentially flip, moving from Republican control to the Democrats. All 435 House seats are up for re-election this year. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the Confederation of African Football unveiling the list of nominees for the men's categories for the 2024 CAF Awards as anticipation builds for the awards evening scheduled for the 16th of December 2024 in Marrakech, Morocco. The CAF Awards 2024 cover the period between January 2024 and October 2024. 10 players have been shortlisted for the coveted CAF Africa Player of the Year Award, just as 10 players feature on the list for the CAF Interclub Player of the Year. Nigerian forward Victor Osimhen was named the CAF African Player of the Year in 2023, while Asisat Oshoala earned the title of CAF Africa Women's Player of the Year. In beach soccer, the CAF Beach Soccer Africa Cup of Nations Egypt 2024 will be decided by defending champions Senegal, as well as competition doubleton Mauritania on Saturday. The two-week competition has reached the finals, with the continental title set to be decided this weekend in Hurghada between the two finalists, who will be meeting for the first time following their Group B match that surprisingly went 5-2 in favor of Mauritania. Staying with CAF, the continent's football ruling body has projected a net profit of $11.7 million in the next financial year. This is a first in several years. The body says the financial health will enable it to deliver on its mandate of developing football in Africa. Patrice Motsepe, who was elected at the helm of CAF in 2021, hailed the body's reduction in losses to $9.2 million from $28.9 million.
We had to introduce governance and ethics and make sure that that there's transparency and auditing practices that are world-class.
In women football, Banyana Banyana, reigning African champions, will take on Denmark in an away international friendly on Friday, 25th of October at the Aalborg Stadium. The South African ladies will then take on their English counterparts 4 days later. The matches will serve as preparation for next year's Women Africa Cup of Nations tournament. And Dile Dlamini, Banyana Banyana goalkeeper, speaks on how important the European tour is for the team.
This is just great, just to play against big opponents like Denmark. This is a different level of play, as you know, they are highly ranked, and I think it will prepare us mentally, physically, and just check where we are at.
And now to basketball, where 11 teams will battle for honors in the Women's Basketball Africa League 2024 Zone 5 qualifiers, scheduled for October 27th to November the 2nd in Zanzibar, Tanzania. This will be the first time the Indian Ocean Island will play host to the event since the regional competition started in Harare, Zimbabwe in 1995. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And And that's it for our This Friday, October 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again Monday morning.